Okay, well, let's talk about the Counter-Reformation in church history. So this is, we're talking about, this is really the Catholic response. Although, there are some historians, some authors like Truman and Lateret that find the term Counter-Reformation unhelpful. For the reason that the Protestant line on the Counter-Reformation has kind of, the traditional line was always kind of that the Catholic Church was just going along just like it was, and then Martin Luther happened. This was kind of the simplistic story. Then Martin Luther happened, and then it all exploded, and then the Catholics got all nervous, and then they had a Counter-Reformation to try and counter the effects of the Protestant Reformation. And that is simplistic. I think as we've been kind of talking about the whole story, you've probably seen that at this point. But the reason is because everybody, another way of looking at it is that everybody knew the Catholic Church needed to be reformed. It was just what ended up developing is two very different approaches to how to reform the Catholic Church. One which ends up in the Protestant Reformation, and one which ends up in the Council of Trent and the ongoing Roman Catholic Church. Because, as we've said before, the Roman Catholic Church, as we understand it today, didn't exist, really, in 1500 A.D. Not really. There were elements of it that were already there, but the Roman Catholic Church, as it exists today, really came into existence at the Council of Trent. That was when they said, yeah, the medieval church was a mess. Everybody knew the medieval church was a mess. But then the Protestant Reformation kind of forces them into action to finally, the impetus is there for them to put into effect the reforms that everybody knew needed to happen. Now there is, as I say here, there is an element of the Catholic Reformation that no question was specifically responsive to the Protestant Reformation. So the term Counter-Reformation, or the idea of it as a response, is not totally inaccurate. There is a lot of it that definitely is a response to the Protestant Reformation. But there were reform currents in Italy and Spain already, you know, before anybody knew the name Martin Luther. There were already lots of people calling for reform in different ways, because everybody knew there was a lot of abuse, a lot of corruption, a lot of ignorance, and so forth. The year 1534, two very important things happened. One of them is that Pope Paul III was crowned as the Pope, and the other is that the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, was formed in France. Pope Paul III, 1534, so remember your time frames. 1511 is, 1517 is the 95 Theses nailed on the door. 1534, John Calvin is just coming to Geneva. So that's kind of the time frame we're looking at. Reformation is well afoot in Germany and Switzerland and in England. We looked last time at the English Reformation. The Reformation in England was just kind of getting started in the year 1534. Pope Paul III is important because Pope Paul III is really the first of the really reform-minded popes. Before Pope Paul III, there were a number of other popes going back to, and their response to the Reformation up until this point is flailing and confused. Because remember, like on a lot of these doctrines, a lot of these subjects, like the doctrine of justification by faith alone, for example, they couldn't say that Martin Luther was a heretic on that doctrine because they didn't have a defined doctrine of justification by faith alone in 1517. They didn't have defined doctrines on a lot of these things. There were, you know, some people believe this, some people believe that, but they didn't have an official Roman Catholic doctrine on a lot of these topics. What they all, remember we talked about before, what they all got in trouble for was refusing the authority of the Pope. That was always the issue. Denying the authority of the Pope or denying the infallibility of the councils. That was why they burned John Huss. That was what Martin Luther was charged with. That was always the issue. So before Paul III, there were some attempts to kind of squash things, and there was some working with trying to convince Charles the V that we've talked so much about, to the Holy Roman Emperor, to try and get a hold on things. But there was also, you know, there was also a movement in Italy and Spain that was known as the Spirituali, or the Spiritualists. And I don't really talk about that in the notes a whole lot. But this was a movement that had an awful lot in common with the Protestant Reformation. That were looking for a more introspective faith, a faith that was less directed towards outward ceremonies and forms, and more about real faith inside, and about piety and repentance and so forth, and had a lot in common. What was the guy's name? He was a famous theologian right at this time, who wrote a treatise, a book, and this was in the late 1530s or the mid 1530s, basically a treatise on theology that disappeared for centuries, and they finally found one lone copy in a library somewhere. It was all suppressed later. This was a popular Catholic theologian in Italy, and a big chunk of that book was copied word for word right out of Calvin's Institutes. So there was a lot of cross currents going on. There was a lot of there was some question about whether Rome, at some of the earlier popes, there was a real question about whether Rome was going to join the Reformation, because there were currents in Rome that were very favorable to Martin Luther, and there were others that weren't. Okay. Paul III is the one who arises to the throne, and he comes out of the Spirituality movement, but he is very much dedicated to the papacy and to preserving the tradition of the papacy, and to responding to the Reformation. He was Pope for 15 years, and that's a big deal. 15 years is the longest reign of any Pope in the 16th century. It's one of the longest reigns of any Pope for several centuries around that. Popes usually did not last that long. Like kings, they usually got assassinated fairly quickly, or they became popes when they were old and would live for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years. And it was a position of, at that time especially, of a immense power and wealth and prestige, and as a result, when somebody became the Pope, somebody usually killed them after, or often killed them after 3, 4, 5 years. A lot of popes were poisoned and stabbed and killed in different ways. Anyway, different subject. He recognized, so the big deal about the actions that he took that really advanced the Counter-Reformation was he recognized the Society of Jesus in 1540. In 1541, he expanded the role of the Inquisition. He established what was known as the Roman Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition was already in effect, and the Roman Inquisition was set up as a permanent office of the Curia, that's the papal government, and the Roman Inquisition's job was to, from a scholarly perspective, to examine books and teachers and authors, and to decide whether or not they were in agreement with Roman Catholic teaching. And it was out of the Roman Inquisition, and in coordination with the Council of Trent, that we get the Index, that we'll talk about later. The Index is the banned list, the list of banned books, the books that a Roman Catholic is not permitted to read. The Index is still in effect, by the way, although its role changed a good deal in Vatican II. So it was in the mid 60s, and this just gives you a lot of kind of perspective. It was in the mid 60s, after Elvis had recorded his best works, before a good Roman Catholic was permitted to read John Stuart Mill or David Hume, for example. So. And I think that really, and a lot of other writers, that really suppressed Catholic intellectual development for a lot of years. Now, since 1962, the role of the you could get a special dispensation if you're a college student or something like that. You could petition Rome for permission to read these things for scholarly purposes. But in general, you couldn't. At Vatican II, it's still a suggestion. It's still like the Index is still there, and they're still saying, be careful when you read those things. But you are now permitted to read them. And it's interesting that I think Catholic intellectual development in the last, some of the best scholars in in Christendom right now are Catholics. There's a lot of Catholics, a very good Catholic scholarly development, intellectual development happening now. But anyway. So that was, as I said, in the 1540s. 1540, the Society of Jesus. Let's talk about that. The Jesuits. The two big figures here are Ignatius Loyola and Francis Xavier. The two of them and five other men were all students at the University of Paris, interestingly at the same time as John Calvin. We have no information whether or not they ever actually met each other, but it is interesting to think that two of the most important figures in the Protestant side of things and the Catholic side of things were on the same campus in the same year. And that's especially Ignatius Loyola and John Calvin. These seven men took a vow together in a crypt beneath a church outside of Paris. Loyola was the main leader at this time. He was the main instigator. He was a Spaniard. He was a knight in Spain. And he'd been wounded in battle in Spain in 1521, a battle with France. And he became a hermit. And after he was wounded, he nearly died. He had this intense religious experience, as people often do when they're wounded and almost die. It's just not uncommon. And he became a hermit for a number of years and lived in a cave all by himself and prayed and prayed and prayed. And out of that, he wrote something called the Spiritual Exercises in 1524. And Spiritual Exercises becomes a hugely important book. This book is, we on the Protestant side of things probably haven't heard of this book, but on the Catholic side of things, one might compare it to some of the really famous devotion, My Utmost for His Highest, or The Imitation of Christ, or things like the Founder Campus Crusades, that Bill Bright, Four Spiritual Laws, those kinds of things. It's the foundation. Every Jesuit, to become a Jesuit, needs to go through the process outlined in Spiritual Exercises. And it's this 30-day period of intense self-reflection and prayer and self-mortification, fasting, and so forth. And then that becomes the foundation for their spiritual life for the rest of their lives. And that is in 1524. It outlines an approach to spiritual devotion which would become the foundation of the Society of Jesus. So they took this vow that they were going to found the Society of Jesus, they were going to advance the gospel, and they were going to advance. And when they say advance the gospel, they mean advance the gospel as understood in the context of the Church of Rome. They were going to advance the Church of Rome, advance the papacy. They had an intense missionary focus. They taught complete obedience to the Pope. The rumor was that one of their vows that they used to take, which is now called into question whether this might have been fabricated, but was that if the Pope said that black was white, that I would believe that black was white. And whether that particular vow was actually there or not, the fact is, the Society of Jesus was always fanatically loyal to the Pope. That was just a core part of their identity. And this was something, when they got recognized in 1540, they had something unique. They had a unique a feature of their organization that wasn't true of any other monastic organization. Every other monastic organization would be under the authority of various or whatever cardinal or bishop was over their territory, right? Where they were, like they had separate chains of authority, but the regular churches that would report up to the cardinal and then to the Pope, and the monastic orders that likewise would report up to the cardinal and then to the Pope, and the cardinal would be over those. If you were the cardinal of, you know, France or Rome or wherever, of England or some other place, the Society of Jesus had no authority other than the Pope himself. They reported directly to the Pope. And otherwise, their whole chain of command was completely independent from the whole rest of the Roman Catholic Church. They had no, and this often led to, first of all, a lot of conspiracy theories on the Protestant side, all sorts of things about what they were secretly doing, which scholars are divided now about how much of that was true and how much of it wasn't, but also a lot of animosity from the other Catholic orders. The Dominicans hated the Jesuits. I think they still do. The Dominicans and the Franciscans, there was an intense competition between them. Because the Jesuits were seen, they have these Johnny-come-latelys, and they also had all this privilege and all these, and they could do these things, and they didn't have to give account for what they were doing, like the other orders did. Another thing that made the Jesuits particularly effective was that unique to the Jesuits, their whole religious life is able to function on an individual basis. A Jesuit does not need a community. He does not need a monastic community in order for him to be faithful to his devotional vows. They were the devotional life of the Jesuit is designed to function to allow the Jesuit to operate independently, for him to travel around and be a missionary. See, none of the other orders work that way. The Dominicans and the Franciscans, they all exist in communities, and the laws they have to follow and the devotional life they follow all revolves around those communities, those monastic communities. The Jesuits could be independent. They could and they did a lot of that. They sent independent Jesuits off all over the world to do their various work. And they were enormously effective. I think from a purely human perspective, they are probably the most effective Christian missionary organization that the world has ever seen. In the latter part of the 16th century, they rolled a lot of the Protestant Reformation back. They recaptured whole big swaths of territory, whole countries, recaptured to the Roman Catholic faith. Francis Xavier was especially famous for his missionary work. Ignatius Loyola never was a missionary. He always claimed he didn't want to, but they made him the head of the Jesuits, and he was the head of the Jesuits in Rome until he died. Until 1556. But Xavier, he went to India in 1541. He preached in India, preached in Japan, preached all over the Far East. And many of those places had never seen Christian missionaries until his death in 1552. The cause of Christianity in Japan in particular, they say there were more Christians in Japan at the end of the 16th century than there are today. There were hundreds of thousands of Christians.
Catholic
Christians, yes.
Were they real Christians?
I'm not going to judge that. I don't know. They were Catholics, for sure. There were some Protestant works there, too. Dutch traders had gone there as well and had started to evangelize some. What happened in about the year 1600, there was a very fierce war of for unification of the Japanese lands, and a man named Tokugawa ended up winning that war, and he had got wind that Jesuit missionaries were often preludes to the Spanish Empire, as it happened in the Philippines. The Philippines, the Jesuits had gone there and converted a whole lot of people to Catholicism, and then the Spanish Emperor sent his troops right behind, and the Philippines fell very easily to the Spanish Empire because so much of the population had been converted to Catholicism and taught to be loyal to the Pope, and the Pope was saying, be loyal to the Spanish Emperor, because the Pope was in the pocket of the Spanish Emperor at the time. So Tokugawa got wind of that in Japan, and he engaged in one of the most brutal and successful suppressions of Christianity that ever happened in the world. He almost entirely destroyed Christianity, crucified hundreds of thousands of people.
I read an account, it was in Christianity Today, I believe, that one of the permanent effects of that Christian movement in Japan was the introduction of Bach.
Of Bach?
Of Bach's music.
Oh, okay.
Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, yeah.
And Bach still has a strong influence, his melodies and so forth, on Japanese popular music.
Oh, interesting.
They don't know where it comes from.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
How funny. Yeah. There were still, when the missionaries came centuries later, the Protestant missionaries after Japan got reopened to the West, they did locate a couple of very, very secluded Christian communities that only had the dimmest memory of what Christianity was even all about. And it was all very, very secret. You couldn't be public about it. So it was all hidden in the language of Japanese popular religion. But it was there. There were still a few.
And there are a few cults in Japan now that study Bach, and they study the religious implications of Bach, and they're being turned toward Christianity.
How interesting.
Remnants of that music.
Oh, how interesting. I never heard that. So anyway, that was Xavier. So and one of the things about the Jesuits that made them so effective is that they were very, very good at adapting themselves to local culture. We have a lot of those debates now within one of the latest ones is what's called the insider movement, where you know that they argue that they should use the language of Islam, for example, as much as they possibly can to gradually introduce people. And then there are others that are saying, no, you're compromising with pagan religions, and you shouldn't do that. You need to be upfront about what this is from the beginning. Well, the Jesuits were the champions of that approach. The Jesuits in India would dress in the garb of Hindu gurus and present the language very much in Hindu language as much as they could in order to kind of gradually win people over. When they first went into China, they dressed as Buddhist monks until they realized the upper classes had contempt for the Buddhists because they were all Confucians, and so then they started dressing as Confucians, which still didn't fool the upper classes, but it fooled a lot of the lower classes. So that was a Jesuit approach. They were not tolerant, however, to what any other branch of Christianity. When they went to India, there were Thomist churches from St. Thomas, churches in India that had been there for over 1,000 years. And the Jesuits did whatever they could to suppress those groups. And as far as Christianity, as far as they were concerned, Rome was the only game in town. But as I said, they were very, very effective. They slowed or reversed the process of the Reformation in many places like Hungary, Poland, and the Spanish Netherlands. They were well-funded by endowments and wills, and at times by grants from Catholic sovereigns. One of the ways they did that, with all the money they had, they'd open lots of colleges and seminaries and orphanages and things like that, and they'd all be free. And so then lots of people would go to those orphanages or seminaries or colleges, and they would get trained in the Roman Catholic faith. And brought, like I said, bringing whole populations back into the Roman fold. They were so effective, they earned the ire of many sovereigns, including Catholic ones. A lot of Catholics viewed them with envy and jealousy because they became enormously wealthy and would funnel tons of money out of those lands and into the Jesuit organization. The rumor was for lots of years, and it was claimed to be a book that was written, but the claim against them was what they would commonly do, is they would find some wealthy, devout widow, all right, who's got, she's got 4 or 5 sons, she would say, or kids, and she'd say, take the oldest one, and say, okay, designate him your heir, he's going to be your heir, he'll inherit the estate, right? All the other kids should go to monasteries or nunneries, and they'd become monks and nuns, right? So then there's no conflict, and then they'd be serving God and serving Christ. So then you've only got one heir to deal with. And there was always a fair chance that heir would die before they inherited their fortune. And then this elderly, devoted widow that had been spending tons of time with the Jesuits priest, that now that her oldest son had, her heir had died, and all the other children are monasteries, now she'd give all her fortune to the Jesuits.
There's a very good chance that he might die with all the Jesuits around.
Well, yes, and with all the Jesuits around. Yeah, so it was enormously effective, but it really agitated. They say that was one of the, they were so effective in Spain in particular, that huge numbers of the most gifted Spanish youth were sent into monasteries and nunneries, and their productivity was lost to the Spanish nation, leading to their impoverishment and weakness later on. Like I said, they were subject to a great many Protestant conspiracy theories as well, right from causing the French Revolution to having sunk the Titanic. The Protestants really did not like the Jesuits, and a lot of the Protestant polemic against the Jesuits is now recognized to have been somewhat overblown, but they were very, very effective. The current Pope is a Jesuit, and it's an ironic thing that the Jesuits today are by far the most liberal of all the Catholic orders, when they were seen in the past as being very conservative, very much towing the line and holding, you know, the power of the Pope and all of that. But now, all of the leading, liberal thinking coming out of Georgetown University, for example, or Notre Dame. These are Jesuit organizations. These are Jesuit universities. All the most liberal thinking is coming out of Jesuit circles.
There was so much hostility to the Jesuits that the They were outlawed.
They were banned. They were banned in the mid 1800s for about a century, I think. And it was an act of the Pope. It was a Pope that was under pressure from Catholic kings. It was a weak Pope, and the Catholic sovereigns were so sick of the Jesuits and how much power they had and how little control anybody had over them that they just
would overturn the excommunications. The cardinal might give an excommunication.
And the Jesuits would just
they would just say a direct line to the Pope,
and they were suspected of coups and overthrowing kings. And again, how much of that is true, it is difficult to know, but they were no doubt enormously effective and powerful for a lot of years.
So is the views of the Pope today in line? They're not just his own views. That's kind of what
he very much reflects the Jesuit thinking today. Very liberal, very socially liberal in lots of ways. That very much reflects modern, as I understand it, modern Jesuit thinking. Council of Trent. Let's talk a little bit about that, unless there are any other questions right now. Council of Trent was a long-running council, first begun by Pope Paul III in 1545 and not concluding until 1563, so almost 20 years. It didn't meet continuously for 20 years. It would meet for 3 or 4 years, and then they would kind of take a break and not get back to it for a couple of years, and then meet for a few more years. The purpose of the council was to respond to the Protestant Reformation as well as addressing a number of long-standing problems in the Roman Church. I'm not going to go through all the back and forth, but essentially this is what comes out of the Roman Catholic Church. It issues a number of declarations of teachings of the Protestants which it considered to be heresies. Justification was said to be on the basis of human cooperation with divine grace. It condemned the idea of assurance of salvation. It taught that God's grace could be lost. So the doctrine of justification by faith alone is at this point declared to be a damnable heresy. The idea of the possibility of being assured of one's salvation, or the idea that you cannot lose your salvation, those are condemned by the council to be damnable heresies. And so now the Roman Catholic Church has an official doctrine of justification. And remember, of course, that councils are considered to be infallible in the Roman Catholic Church. And that means that all of these things that we're talking about here continue to be the infallible doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. The doctrine of the sacraments. The 7 sacraments were reaffirmed. The Mass was taught to be a propitiatory sacrifice that truly removes sins. The true physical presence of Christ's body is affirmed at the Council of Trent. Clerical celibacy was reaffirmed as the official position of the Church. Before that, clerical celibacy, you remember that was Innocent III that really started pushing that in a big way. But even then, it was never, there wasn't an encyclical or a papal bull issue that's saying this is the official doctrine. It was the practice, and it was enforced, haphazardly, usually. But it was never said to be the official doctrine until the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent established that as the official doctrine of the Church. The Council reaffirmed common medieval doctrines such as the veneration of Mary, the veneration of saints and relics, pilgrimages, purgatory, the use of indulgences, though it did ban the sale of indulgences. It still said you could issue indulgences to people for performing some meritorious work for the Church. And that still included giving money to the Church. But you couldn't be so naked as to just sell the indulgence. You could say, hey, if you donate a couple of gold crowns to the building of the cathedral, then we will issue you an indulgence. So they kind of had a little workaround. And that's still the position of the Church. They still do that. They're not so open about it as they used to be. But they still do that. You can still get indulgences from the Roman Catholic Church. Well, you can't order them on a website, but that would be convenient, wouldn't it? You just go and put in your credit card number. And all these other things. Again, all these things that we say, these are, A lot of the things that really characterize the Roman Catholic Church, these things, as I said, these things had all been controversial before Trent. These things had all been things that might be practiced in some parts of the church, but not in others. There were always people who said these things are being abused, or, you know, that maybe the veneration of Mary was really important to some, but to others, like, that's probably not a great idea. Saints or pilgrimages or so forth. The Council of Trent, all these things become the official doctrine of the Catholic Church, become established. And that's why I say that when we think of the Roman Catholic Church today, that church came into existence in 1562, or 1563, at the conclusion of the Roman Catholic Church. That doesn't mean these things were never practiced before then, but they were never the universal position of the church. They were always debated, and there were some places that did and some places that didn't, to varying degrees and so forth. But after Trent, this becomes the official position of the church. The council established an index, as I mentioned earlier, a list of books that were forbidden to be read. It was also called, it also called for the publication of standard forms and worships of worship and a catechism, although the specifics were left to the Pope. The Catholic Catechism actually comes out later on. It's mostly the work of the papal office. It was not written by the council, but the council directed it for the writing of a catechism. And that's ironic. That's a, you know, catechisms today by a lot of people are thought of as a Catholic thing, is the Catholic catechism. But the Catholic catechism was written in response to the Protestants because of how successful the Protestant catechisms have been. Luther's catechism was written long before the Catholic catechism. And there were other catechisms that were in existence before Luther all back through the history of the church. None of them had universal use. They were always to be like some local priest or bishop. He'd have his own catechism that he'd use. Sometimes if it was well written, it'd be more popular with people around him. There was never one that was established. But it was Luther's catechism. And then the catechisms of 1562, by then, you see, Calvin's dead by then. That means his catechism's already been written. The Heidelberg Catechism was written, was that 1559 or 1563? But even the Heidelberg Catechism was kind of the culmination of a long string of catechisms that had been used in various Protestant churches. It was just the best and most successful of them, and so it became the standard for the Continental Reformed churches. But so the Catholic Catechism was written in response to Protestant catechisms, I just think we need to never get tired of telling our Catholic friends that. But anyway,
that's a really interesting point, though, because I think that the catechism in the Reformed churches makes a lot of people from evangelical churches think that Reformed is Catholic.
Right. There's a catechism. Are you Catholic? Yeah.
Exactly. So
you have to explain that. It says, no, they stole our idea. And even that's not really, I mean, there had been catechisms long before there had been Protestants. But it was the Protestants that really made them successful and really made, and that was one of the things that Trent was trying to deal with, was one of the reasons that the Protestant Reformation had been so successful was that the Protestants were so much better at teaching their kids than the Catholics had been. And that was why it was one of the reasons it was spreading so fast. So a big part of Trent was education and standard forms, standard catechisms, and then the Jesuits, their role in that too. And that was how they really fought back, and they said, we need to start educating our kids, like they're doing. That was a big part of it. The use of Latin was strongly promoted. The idea that worship should be held in the common language of the people was condemned. Council attempted some reform of the worst abuses of medieval churches, having to do with, for example, the moral of convents, the lack of education of the clergy, and absenteeism. You remember that one of the things that characterized the medieval church was you would have a priest that or a bishop that held a particular see, and he might hold four or five or six different sees, and he might not live near any one of them, and he'd just appoint vicars, uneducated people who would go through the forms in the actual district, but he'd never be there. And he would, you know, the people would get given bishoprics when they were 12 years old, you know, and just as, and it would just be like an income, like a dad might give his kid a rental property, you know. It says, well, here you can manage this rental property and get the income from it. Here's a bishopric, you know. And it, I mean, it had nothing to do with merit or anything. It was just property to be traded. Trent did some work to try it, and they did a lot, actually, I should say. Those worst of the abuses of the medieval church were greatly lessened by some of the policies that were put in place in Trent. I think they said a bishop couldn't hold more than two bishoprics at once, with some provision like that, to really try and limit that a lot. The Council of Trent led to a much greater uniformity in the Roman Catholic Church than was the case before. Often scholars today will refer to the term Tridentine Christianity. And by that they mean the form of Christianity, the form of Catholicism that came into existence at the Council of Trent. That there were the Tridentine, it comes from the Latin name for that town. But Trentian Christianity is the Roman Catholic Church today is Tridentine Catholicism. And that's when that came into existence. All of these currents were there before to some degree or another, but they were never official. And it was at Trent that they all became official. And that, as I said, is when the church became what it is today in many, many ways. Any questions about any of that? Comments?
Can we draw any parallels from what we preached about in the Jews to Roman Catholic Church?
Well, I think so. I think a lot of what drove the elevation of the Roman Church was just pride. It was just, we're Roman. And remember, this was back in the day when Rome ruled the world, right? And that pride just continues all the way down. We are Rome, we're the popes, we're the real deal, you know, and that's what matters. You know, everybody's subject to pride, of course. I think that was the way that took shape, and that was one of the things that the reformers constantly criticized Rome for, was a great pride they had. They just wouldn't listen to anybody because they were Rome, we're the deal, we're, you know, we go back to the emperors and the great empire, and trying to constantly recreate that glory, you know. So I think so.
You see the irony of it too, in that the Jews were saying, we're not slaves to anybody, we've never been slaves to anybody, and yet they were slaves in Rome. And now it's the church is taking pride in the fact that they are part of Rome.
yeah. That is ironic, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Well, it seems like, I mean, a lot of the doctrine here from the Council of Trent, it really is based on pride. I mean, you know, even the veneration of Mary, the idea that mere human could be, well, worth venerating.
Right. And the saints.
Because what they're really saying to themselves, and the appeal there is that, well, if I do a better job, then maybe somebody will venerate me.
Then I can be like this too.
I kind of feel like there's some of that motivation there. Or, and you know, just, indulgences even. I mean, like you can do anything to deserve salvation,
right,
or something.
You know, before Trent, I have always tried, as we've discussed, I've always tried to present as balanced a picture of the church as I could, to say, yeah, there were these bad things here, but there were also these good things. A lot of Protestant scholars will point to Trent at the point at which the Roman church becomes officially apostate. And I think there's a pretty good argument for that. You know, Trent is where they say that the doctrine of justification by faith alone is a damnable heresy. And I think at that point you could say this is no longer a true church. This is now an apostate church. And that they not only don't practice the right doctrine, but they officially condemn the right doctrine.
I think there were really two watersheds in the Roman church. One was the Constantine.
Yeah.
When he created the imperial church.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that continued for 1,000 years.
Right, yeah.
And then what you said about the
Trent.
And all during that time, they practiced celibacy, but it wasn't universal.
No, off and on, and some and it depends on the district and the bishop and a lot of things. Yeah.
Schopp had a good quote on that. He said, "Man's traditions cannot overcome human depravity."
Yeah, it's true.
That's the term practice.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If they practice celibacy, or they were celibate.
Yeah, they're practicing at it.
So, through all that, did the Catholic Church lose any other people except Protestants, or did everybody who left the church just become labeled a Protestant? whether they agreed or not.
That's right. And basically, there were the two camps, and they were the Catholics and the Protestants. And the Protestants were everybody that left the Catholics.
Yeah, so
now, there were always still the Eastern Christians or Eastern Orthodox, the Oriental Orthodox, and all of them. But yeah, the Protestants becomes a label for a very big group of very different people. You know, everybody from the Lutherans to the Anabaptists, you know, and everything in between. They all get kind of collected. And so you do have, but you're right to point, it wasn't one monolithic movement. It had a lot of people splitting off the Catholic Church for a lot of different reasons, and it had been a process that had been going on for hundreds of years. There had been the Cathari, there had been the Paulicists, there had been the Waldensians that we talked about, you know, but none of them were very successful. They all got suppressed and they all got beat up because it was just like one at a time. Now it was such a mass movement, so many different people all at once, you know, when Luther gets away with it and, you know, whole big states of the Holy Roman Empire become Protestant, then a lot of other people say, hey, now's our chance. You know, we can do this too. And we can finally get away.
If
and
Protestant means, I mean, is it correct that, you know,
to protest.
Right, the French, it's French, protest, to protest.
Right.
That's what it came from.
The name first gets used at the Council of Trent, actually. And the Protestants, there were some Protestant leaders that were invited to the Council of Trent.
Yes.
They got there late, and they'd already discussed justification by faith alone before the Protestants got there. So it was pretty much all baked in the cake already. But some did go, and they protested. They protested what the Council was doing. And that's how they all kind of collectively got the name Protestant. Before then, it would be most common to just refer to them as Lutherans.
Yeah.
Even though anybody who was breaking away from the Catholic Church, they'd just be called Lutherans. Even though an awful lot of them bore little resemblance to Luther's doctrine. So, yeah, they were protesting what the council was doing, and that's how they got the name.
One of the differences, I think, that with the Protestant Reformation and the Lutheran Reformation is that the dissident groups were able to engage princes and noblemen and rulers of Germany was very fractured, and they wanted to get civil power.
Right.
Of course, that led to wars.
And that led to other kinds of problems.
Yeah.
But and we talked about that, about how the fact that an awful lot of civil rulers embraced the Reformation, probably for mostly political reasons, because they wanted to get out from under the thumb of the Habsburgs. So God used that to advance the cause.
It helps to have a pious reason when you're dancing around the golden gate.
Anything else?
It just seems like, you know, like what you said earlier about parallel. I mean, to me, these guys are distinctly parallel to you had the Mosaic Law or whatever. At least that kind of had its. Some of it's basic in the Old Testament, but this is just a new set of rules.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a very similar motivation underlying it. The idea that these outward forms and works will gain us the favor of God and the blessings of heaven. And that's what the Pharisees did, and part of the Protestant polemic often ran right along those lines to say this is the same thing that the Jews were guilty of that Jesus criticized them for. The reliance on ceremonies and forms to earn our favor with God. And it was absolutely right.
That's exactly what happened to the so-called Christian kingdoms. Of Holland and England and Austria-Hungary and Spain and Italy and so forth, prior to World War I, they just couldn't. And Russia,
they were all
apostate churches
falling into nominalism and formalism.
And therefore, we are the people of God.
Right,
God on our side. It's a righteous cause here. And it was
because you know, as I tried to draw out in the sermon, this is the natural human condition.
Yeah.
You know, we naturally fall into this. We naturally fall into ways that, you know, and the more external and obvious those ways are, the better, because then everybody can see them.
Yeah.
It's funny that the laws that people use to justify themselves in God's eyes are most frequently the laws that other people are sure to see them doing. You know, things that are obviously visible so that they can show everybody else what good Christians they are or what good people they are in general. It's just common. It's just human nature.
Horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if that is your saying, it's a human condition.
That's why institutions don't last. That's why every time there's a good institution, it takes 100 years. And it's
they fall into nominalism, fall into pride.
It's original focus. And so a new group comes up, or a splinter comes off, or something, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just how it is. You have good institutions, and they fall. Every university, every denomination.
God continually overturns, and that's how he does his work.
Death and resurrection.
Well, any other questions? Or why don't we close in prayer? Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for your blessings. Thank you for your grace and your sovereignty in preserving your church through all the centuries. Lord, we pray that as we study these things, that we would not fall into pride, and we would not fall into a mindset of how much better we are than others. Remind us, Lord, that all that we have is grace, and that if we are elevated in pride, then we will lose that just as well as they did. So, Lord, we pray that you would confirm us in humility and in obedience to your word in all things, that we might glorify you with our words and works, Lord. We pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.